all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We're going to have a discussion today with individuals who were working behind the scenes to get Medal of Honor recipient Paris Davis the Medal of Honor, which he did receive many years after Vietnam, and then also an interview with some guys, real patriots, who have been working to support veterans in their time of need. It's a Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund, and we talked to some of their board members. So listen in. Both of these are interesting stories. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today two special guests to talk about a recent Medal of Honor recipient, Colonel Paris Davis. And we're going to talk to the guys who, I always refer to these kind of guys as Sherpas. They carried a lot of the heavy load up the hill to get this accomplished, as did a whole team of people. But we have on Neil Thorne, an Army veteran and researcher extraordinaire. Neil, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim.
And we also have with him Jim Moriarty, a Marine veteran, did three tours in Vietnam. He's an attorney working in the mass torts area, a lot of work with veterans and military-related causes. He did a dozen years or so with the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation and finds himself helping out where he can. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's good to be with you.
Well, you guys got connected on this project for Colonel Paris Davis in back in Vietnam 58 years ago. He was a captain involved with the Green Berets and Special Forces. His heroics at the Battle of Bung Son really is what launched this effort to have him recognized and receive the Medal of Honor. But Neil, why don't you give a brief description of Colonel Davis's exploits? That I think it was a 19-hour battle.
Yeah. So Colonel Davis was on his second tour in Vietnam in 1965, and he volunteered to go in to Bong Song, which to that point had been under enemy control, and we had not been able to get a foothold there. He moved into that area, created a civil irregular defense group, CIDG group, of what they call rough puffs. So they were local inhabitants that were recruited into a small army. So he built an army there, along with his fellow Green Berets, their A-team. And their first action out was this Battle of Bong Son. And Colonel Davis led that action, engaged and devastated the enemy, and also saved his troops, who he was ordered to leave his wounded at one point, and he refused to do so. And it was a colonel who had ordered him to leave, and at that time he was a captain, so he refused to leave his troops. He went out and rescued, personally rescued three of them, while engaging the enemy, while also coordinating air assets and medevacs and artillery on the site. And it's just one of the if you read the accounts of the battle, it is just one of the most heroic actions I've seen.
And if I understand it right, Jim Moriarty, he was also injured during this battle. So he's not only recovering guys, he's doing well. He's being shot and injured, but again, won't leave the battlefield, even though told to. Do I have that right?
Yeah, he was injured several times. He was hit with grenade fragments and lost the ability to use his trigger finger. So he was forced to shoot his rifle with his pinky, and he was shot in the leg. And he still stayed in the fight.
Well, the accounts of that battle right at that time noted the heroics here. And I should mention that then Captain Paris Davis was one of the first African-American or black special forces officers and serving in Vietnam at that time. And this is 1965. Ish, so you know the country is still dealing with a lot of racial issues, but awards and decorations in the military are all about the next guy up the line, writing it up and sending it up. So, Neil, why don't you talk a little bit about what happened in that 1965 period about write-ups and why it's 58 years later and we're only now talking about him being awarded the Medal of Honor.
First things that you do when trying to recover or look at any of these medals and awards is FOIA all of the surrounding information. And the National Archives had what they called the Paris Davis Medal of Honor packet. Well, we FOIA'd that and got it back, and it was not a 1965 Medal of Honor packet at all. What it was a 1969 hearing into his medals and awards and the Medal of Honor. In those documents, we also found official testimony given to this Army hearing by his commander, Billy Cole, that he had indeed written him up for the Medal of Honor and had taken it to Nha Trang with the 5th Group headquarters at that time. And also, we found supporting evidence that this was written up by his commander in 1965 interviews with the reporter, Charlie Black. There are two instances of him mentioning that, you know, he'd written Colonel Davis. So that's what led to us discovering that this was truly a lost award, that it had been created. The packet and paperwork had been assembled. It was put in at Nha Trang, and at that point, it should have generated a first review, and multiple copies would have gone out. They would have gone to Saigon, they would have gone to CINCPAC, and ultimately the Pentagon. And no copies were ever found. So that choke point at group headquarters at Nha Trang was where we determined, you know, that it had been most likely trashed. Well, because you just don't misplace something like
that. This is about the most important thing that's going up the chain at this point. And you get to the point, I think, as an experienced researcher as you are, where something doesn't smell right at that point, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it's not even a small packet at that. It would have probably been at minimum 40 pages. And even our recreated Medal of Honor packet was around 90 some.
Well, this gets lost, quote unquote, lost in the 1960s, and then just sort of goes away. Nobody talks about it. How does and Jim Moriarty, why don't you jump in here? How do you keep this alive, this issue alive for so long? I know you got involved about 8 years ago, but you'd worked on some of these other things. And when Neil called you up and said, hey, you want to put your talents to work here? You said yes, but it had to be like, wait a minute, this has been cold for decades.
Well, that's only partially true. In 1969, there was an inquiry. Billy Cole, who was the battalion commander, was still alive at that time, and he was pushing this from the get-go. And there was, we found orders that they had been ordered to recreate the award package, but nobody ever saw that award package again. And then in 1981, Billy Waugh, who is probably the most famous or the most notorious, depending on how you look at it, Special Forces CIA guy, who was one of the people whose parents saved, Billy Waugh submitted a letter, not sworn to, that talked about Paris's heroics and character, and he tried to keep it alive. And there was an Army Ranger, you know, there was a whole platoon of Sherpas, as you describe them, trying to keep this deal alive, but nobody really knew where the friction points were, where the obstacles were, until Neil got involved in about 2014. Neil had been working on the Gary Michael Rose Medal of Honor rising out of Operation Tailwind. And so Neil got involved in that with the team of, I guess, half a dozen mostly former Army guys that were trying to push the thing forward. And Neil turned out to be the most knowledgeable, experienced, aware of the regulations and the problem guy. And he jumped in with both feet and ended up really taking over the program because of his vast knowledge. That's when he shows up like a kitten on my doorstep saying, well, we got this little problem.
Sweet talked him right into it, didn't you, Neil?
Yeah, you know, like a complete dumbass. I had completely forgotten about the don't volunteer for nothing.
See, so he was Army, you were Marine. You walked right into it.
I knew it was time to call in the Marines.
Well, Neil, this is one of these things where you go, like, it doesn't smell right. It doesn't feel right. What happened? How do you lose two packages of this size? And knowing the regulations as you do, time's your enemy on these because you're losing witnesses, you're losing certifications. Tell us about some of those hurdles.
Well, we lost Sergeant Morgan was one of the men that was on it. He was killed 3 months after the action. He was most likely one of the first eyewitnesses. And we had Billy Wall. Billy Wall was still surviving. And we also had the testimony of his commander, Billy Cole, who had the foresight to have his daughter notarize it, write it down and notarize it for him. Plus, we had all kinds of surrounding supporting evidence, including those 1969 documents the National Archives are holding.
And you essentially recreated a package. It's not the original. It's not the second go-round. It's a third package, if you will, for the Medal of Honor for Colonel Paris Davis. But now, how do you get that? Okay, I got a bunch of documents here. How do I push that forward? Who is this where the connections help?
Some. Generally, there's everything that's required in a packet. So it's a DA Form 638 nomination for award, and it's got to be filled out perfectly. You have to have signatures of anybody in the chain of command or note, you know, where they have, if they're deceased or when they have died. You also have to have a proposed narrative, a proposed citation, eyewitness statements, supporting evidence. There's a whole checklist of parts that go into any medal and award packet. Also, the description of the action, the after-action reviews, stuff like that. So that's pretty general for any medal or award, any valor medal or award. So once you get all that put together in a general order, along with a summary, that's when you need to find a member of Congress who is a pass-through. So this falls under the U.S. Code Title 10, Section 1130, which is a process for lost, missing, or downgraded medals and awards. So then we then went up to Capitol Hill to find someone who would not only pass it through, but we were also looking for somebody who would be a champion of it as well. We found some, it's no problem finding somebody to pass it through. And we got in Senator Kane's and Warner's offices to do that for us. And then it's a matter of following up with Fort Knox, which is the awards and decorations branch, the first gatekeeper, making sure they got it, making sure they understand it, making sure that everything is complete. And a first kickback is almost guaranteed with anything, because that's kind of them doing their due diligence. And then you address that. So it's constantly putting together the packet, getting the packet submitted, making sure it's in the channel, and then babysitting it.
And this is really a labor of love for the team that's doing this. This is time that Jim Moriarty's putting in, this time Neil Thorne's putting in, and other people are putting in, trying to advance this. And you were involved in it for 9 years. Other people had been in maybe longer, but really the work over the 8-9 years, is there a point at which you say, hey, this is going nowhere? Or you just have to stay on it and believe that in the end you'll be successful?
We knew we were in the right from the beginning, and we knew that an injustice had been done, and it was still existing. So the thought of giving up didn't occur to us.
So let me put this to Jim Moriarty, who probably has to dance a little less than Neil does on sensitive issues, because Neil's, as they say, this nationally renowned researcher, and Jim's a lawyer and a Marine. So you knew you were in the right on this, because there was clearly some biases going on back in the 60s, back in the 80s, even into the here in the 2000s, the 2020. I mean, do you confront those directly? I know as a trial lawyer, a mass tort trial lawyer, you like to confront things directly, but how do you navigate this to advance it but confront the biases?
Jim, you're asking a pretty sophisticated question.
Well, I'm going to a sophisticated guy who grew up in Texas. You can deal with this. I know you can.
There's I lived during the 60s. I spent 2.5 years in Vietnam. I know what the military was like, and I know what the United States was like in terms of the prevalence of racism in the 60s, in the 70s, and the 80s, and indeed today. So the fact that the first package disappeared could have been an accident. The fact that the second package disappeared, now it's no longer an accident. It's sort of like the Twin Towers. When one fell, maybe it was a navigational problem. When they both went down, it was a deliberate act. Neil and I gnashed our teeth about this because I didn't want to make this case about racism, but also wasn't going to take no for an answer. So we pussyfooted around the issue when we redid the package in 2015 and 2016, where we didn't hang our hats on the racism issue, but we tried to let the reader figure out for themselves what had happened.
Certainly.
In 2016, and it was a unrelenting battle. I was serving on the board of directors of the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation. Richard Spencer was Secretary of the Navy. Jim Mattis was Secretary of Defense. John Kelly, who I worked for, was initially Homeland Security, and then he goes over to Chief of Staff of the White House. I had the best connections in the administration that I could possibly have, and I was hitting on every single one of them. Because the idea that this man was not going to be awarded the Medal of Honor for what he did was simply not in my vocabulary. And what I did, I went up to Mattis at the awards dinner, and I had these two chapters from Billy Cole's memoirs that tell the history of the Vietnam War. Schwarzkopf's in there, Peter Arnett's in there, John Wayne's in there, Barry Sadler, the legend of the Green Beret. I mean, these two chapters, which are only cover a small part of the war, really were core history of the war. And Billy Cole tells this wonderful story about how extraordinary Harris's courage was. And, you know, my attitude was, anybody's got an IQ over 75 that reads this is going to realize this guy definitely needs to get the Medal of Honor. Well, Neil successfully pushed the award out of Knox. The initial naysayer was Fort Knox, and we got it out of there. In fact, we later learned that the I think it was Ray Epps, who was the acting Secretary of the Army in 2017 or 2018, sent it out of the Army to the Secretary of Defense's office, and that turned out to be where the real hurt was. There were two confounding facts. Confounding fact number one is Billy Waugh has spent way too many years with the CIA, and sometimes his stories don't match. And Billy, in his 1981 letter, which was turned into an affidavit in, I think, the early teens, where Billy swears that Harris saved his life, as he did, Billy comes out with a couple of so-called books. One of them was Stalking the Jackal or something like that. And in these books, he tells the Battle of Bom Song, where he sort of set out to be the controlling hero, and he claims some guy named Reinberg saved his life. Now, so there's two confounding facts. One of them is that Billy Waugh says at one point in time, Harris Davis saved my life. At another point in time, Reinberg saved his life. That was confounding fact number one. Confounding fact number two is that in 1969, 4 years after the battle, Reinberg is awarded the DSC. And in his DSC citation, it says that he saved the life of a soldier. Now, keep in mind, there's 200 rough puffs out there, the South Vietnamese CIDG soldiers, and there were four Americans. The Silver Star citation, the interim Silver Star citation that was issued in 1965 for Paris, specifically credits him for saving the life of his team sergeant. And his team sergeant is Billy Waugh. So, in my view, there was no confounding evidence except that Billy Waugh was having a hard time keeping his story straight, but there was so much supporting evidence, Billy Cole's memoirs, other witnesses' statements, Billy Waugh's earlier sworn affidavit, that I thought this Reinberg business was just all bullshit. I thought, you know, nobody in their right mind would think that there's a conflict with who Harris saved, because this very Silver Star citation says it was his team sergeant. There was only one team sergeant on the mission. And what really proved to be interesting throughout this 8-year battle, as I focused in on finding the crew chiefs from the helicopters, finding the pilots from the helicopters, finding the remaining living witnesses from the battle. We literally, and to tell you the length we went to find supporting evidence, I think there was a New York Times story where there was a FAC pilot who was describing his part in the mission, and the guy's name was Speedy Gonzalez. So here's all the facts I know about Speedy Gonzalez. He's in the Air Force. He flies a Ford Air Controller aircraft, and his name is Speedy Gonzalez. Like, I'm supposed to do something with that?
Well, start searching.
Computer researcher about not having the slightest clue where I'm going to find this guy. And all I was doing was just bitching. I wasn't making a request. Well, I go to bed and I wake up the next morning and I've got Speedy Gonzalez's name and address and phone number on my email. And it turns out he's a retired Air Force pilot who lives over in San Antonio. And I jump in the car and drive over to interview him.
Oh, my goodness.
And I tracked down some of the Huey pilots. You know, the pushback, part of the pushback we got is, well, we need more living eyewitnesses. And I'm sitting there going, you son of a bitches have waited 50 years until almost everybody's dead, and now you want more living eyewitnesses? As it turned out, the Reinberg problem was the core problem, because there was, in my view, a single individual in the Department of Defense's office who took the position that Reinberg's DSC trumped everything. Now, keep in mind, Neil and I have talked to more living witnesses and now deceased witnesses who knew about that mission than any other two people on the planet. And nobody has ever said anything about Reinberg ever saving anybody. Not Colonel Cole, not anybody else on the mission, not Ron Dice, nobody. Not Paris Davis, not this 19. We actually tracked down the hour-long Phil Donahue interview with Ron Dice and Paris. And where Paris tells the whole story about how this deal went down. And you can't watch that without concluding there's a guy who was there who knows what happened and who's describing what happened. Now, of course, you can't be awarded a Medal of Honor on your own testimony. You got to be awarded a Medal of Honor based on other people's testimony. But it was certainly corroborative evidence. And Ron Dice was a direct eyewitness to important facts. But go ahead.
I wanted to come back to this, how you break this loose, because this thing got lost a couple of times, then it got hung up at Fort Knox for a period of years, then it got hung up in the Secretary of Defense's Office of Manpower and Reserve Affairs apparently for 3 years, then it got hung up in I think the Office of the Secretary of Defense. How every time it gets hung up, how do you bust it loose, Neil?
Well, I want to answer that question because I was there when the page was blank. We were stopped dead in our tracks in the fall of 2020. We had done everything we knew. We had gone to everybody that had any pull. We had found more witnesses. We'd found more facts. And we were up against the wall. Now, we weren't quitting, but we also weren't succeeding. And Chris Miller gets appointed acting Secretary of Defense. And I get a call from now Major General Kevin Leahy, who says, look, Miller's a fifth group guy. He's a good guy. You know, I had been pushing to have my son awarded a Medal for Valor for his combat when he was killed, which the Army wouldn't grant because he was supposedly working for somebody besides the Army. But Leahy calls me. And so I said, let's go do something. But oh, by the way, while we're there asking for some relief, we need to ask for some relief for Paris Davis. So Leahy calls me back the next day, says, I've talked to Miller. Miller's a good guy. He's on it like stink on you know what. And he's going to appoint one of his key aides to work with you on the Congressional Medal of Honor for Paris Davis. So he assigns this former JAG officer to work with me. We jump back in it with both feet, and this time we confronted the racial issue head on. It was a I had had enough. It was I just don't want to hear. We lost the package twice, but we have no idea what that relates to.
Right.
Well,
right.
You know, that's just nonsense. That is so incredible. So we jumped in. We did a multimedia presentation. And by this time, there was a team of thousands on the Sherpa team. I get a call from one of my buddies in San Antonio or in Houston, who's a former fifth grade guy, and he's talked a game company executive in Great Britain into doing graphics for us. So, for example, one of the key points that we had was that Paris had saved another soldier's life 2 months before Vong Son. And had been awarded a Soldier's Medal. I think he's one of only six. Neil would know better
four.
Than I do.
Yeah.
Six people have been awarded Soldier's Medal and medals for valor. So they're doing all these graphics for us. We tracked down photographs from Ron Dice and other people so we can recreate the mission. And what we also did was we did an overlay of what was going on in the United States at exactly the same time that Paris Davis was so heroically serving our country.
Right, right.
The riots in Selma, that famous bridge that they just had the 58th anniversary on. So we confronted it head on, and we did this multimedia presentation, which if you haven't seen it, I would certainly encourage you to see it. And we put this whole package together in about 6 weeks. And then Chris Miller, before Trump went out of office, issued an order that the Department of Defense was to do a review of this whole process, basically to answer the question, why hadn't this been done a long time ago? And so that's what busted it loose. And then the really weird deal is that after Trump left office and after the Biden administration came in, then we continued to get a year and a half of pushback.
Many Medal of Honor recipients are, and they are humble men who have done extraordinary things, but they you know, served. They knew what their duty was, and they went way beyond it. But getting the award is not about necessarily about their individual recognition or rewards. It's really for the community, and we were talking about this earlier, Jim Moriarty, on the getting Purple Hearts for guys, and it's really about what this will mean to Paris Davis's family. The African American community, the Special Forces community, that much larger recognition that the Medal of Honor provides to folks. And
so now you've heard the backstory on how Paris Davis finally got recognized after multiple lost packages for his heroics in the Medal of Honor. These are amazing stories that we're able to bring to you on Veterans Radio, and it's because of the sponsors like National Veterans Business Development Council. It has some upcoming events that you may want to participate in. So go to nvbdc.org and check that out. If you're a veteran-owned business, you may want to get certified for all the valid reasons that they talk about. We'll have a few words from sponsors and then back to talk about and listen to an interview with Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a couple of the board members of the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund, a Michigan-based organization. It's a 501c3, been around for a while, and we're glad to have Chris Cornelius as a board member on with us. Chris is a veteran and actually one of the co-founders of the fund, and we have the president of the fund, Robert Grimaldi, on as well. Both these guys have been involved with the fund for quite a number of years, and it was time to come back around and talk about what they've been doing over the years and some of the success stories and upcoming events. Chris, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Jim, thanks for having us.
Rob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. Thanks for having us. And, you know, for all those who don't know, Jim has been a staunch supporter of veterans and all their concerns and issues for many, many years. So thank you for all the work you've done over the years.
Well, thank you. Chris, I'm going to start with you because you were there at the beginning in 2006. Talk to us about what you saw, what the group saw as the need, and what the mission and purpose of Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund is.
Well, when we started, it was early 2006, like you had mentioned, and one of the issues that were happening at the time there was that the time that it would take for veterans to get their VA claims awarded was very long, and we were also dealing with something I would consider new to the VA was because of the IED explosions, was traumatic brain injuries. So we kind of recognized really quickly that there's a gap there, and other things too. It's not just the TBI, but sometimes it takes a little bit longer than what it should be for a veteran to get some help. So we just decided we're going to step together as a community and help out Michigan veterans.
Well, one of the things that I always found amazing about this board and this effort was it is a all-volunteer effort, and it really involves the business community. Rob, why don't you talk a little bit about who gets involved and who helps out with Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund?
Yeah, and you hit it on the head. It's an all-volunteer organization, which, from the first days that Chris and the other founders created Fallen and Wounded Soldier Fund, it was always going to be about direct impact on the lives of the veterans and their families, and it wasn't going to be about any of the other, you know, things. Overhead costs were always going to be kept very, very low. To this day, as much as we've grown and added things, we're still about 97 cents of every dollar. It's a little higher than that, but goes directly into the hands of a veteran in need. As opposed to overhead expenses, we have zero paid staff. So we're a working board. We've got 15 board members. And that's what drives everything we do. So when you see a fast response to a veteran, that's a board member that's working hard to make sure that we do all of our diligence and get things, all the boxes checked, and then get the money out to the veteran in the way that it needs to go. When you see an event that we put on, we're not paying somebody to do that. That's us out there doing the hard work. So, you know, the board members just come really from across, you know, the spectrum, just people that believe in helping veterans in need. When it comes to things like corporate sponsors and, you know, individual sponsors and volunteers and just all those kind of other people that are out there helping us and supporting us, that runs the gambit too. You know, it can be, you know, sometimes it's organizations that you may think would have an interest in veterans, and helping those veterans that are in need. But it's also, you know, that company up the road that you may or may not have done business with, but, you know, they have, for whatever reason, the desire to help veterans. So that's been one of the areas that's been kind of fun to watch, is just all the different people that get involved and help, and all the different stories. You know, people know veterans, right, within their lives, whether it's a brother, a father, whether it's somebody up the road that served. And, you know, hopefully none of them have any of the issues that we deal with, but we run across those too. You know, a kid up the road that got hurt. And I remember the difficulties he had when he returned and had this injury. And they love that groups like us are out there helping. So, you know, we just really run the gambit across everybody here in Michigan that's really willing to help. And then we get a lot of people that realize what we do is important, but also the way we do it is so efficient. And the fact that, you know, again, going back to that direct impact, they give us a dollar, it's going where they want it to go. It's not going to, you know, parties or expenses or overhead or advertising or marketing. It's going to the veterans. So that part really helps us gain supporters and keep supporters.
Well, I think one of the things that has always worked well for Fallen Wounded Soldiers Fund, Chris, is that direct support. There's not a whole lot of middlemen. You don't give money to agencies who give it to somebody else. You really have a model that lets you get, when necessary, the dollars right in the hands of the veteran. Can you talk about how that works?
Sure. Yeah, we have a website that any veteran can go on to, or a family member, or even a friend, and contact us and say, here, this is what's going on. And or there's a phone number they can call as well on the website. And what happens is that goes right to our distribution committee, and that the distribution committee chair will call the veteran back generally within 24 to 48 hours. From there, she gathers all the pertinent information, and then every Monday that committee meets, and that's when they make a determination. And from there, the checks are cut that week. So you're looking at cases many times in less than a week they're getting distributions. So it's as quick as it can be.
Yeah, and just to kind of fill in there, it's I think people don't really understand how direct we interact with veterans, but Chris is right. They make a phone call into the website. It's an 800 number, but it rings directly to our executive director, Dr. Lynn Phillips. And, you know, typically we measure response in days, not weeks or months, but really it rarely goes past a full day where we haven't had contact with the veteran. And it rarely goes past a week where we haven't done the sufficient amount of diligence. And we take that part very serious. You know, you can call and say, hey, I'm a veteran and I have this injury and I have this need. And we just can't take that at face value, right? We have to kind of corroborate all of those things and do the – so we have to figure out, okay, this is, in fact, a veteran. They have engaged with the VA. You know, they do have the injuries that they stated. They were honorably discharged. And then we have to go back and figure out that each of these bills or whatever it is that they need help with are legitimate. And then on top of all that, we can't just write a check and hand it out to a veteran, you know, because we can't ensure that if we're paying five different bills that all five of those would go. 99% of the time, it probably would, but we want to be very careful with the money that comes into us from other donors, and we want them to feel comfortable knowing that it's going to the right spot. So that means we're paying bills direct. And again, we can't wait a week or a month in many cases. Sometimes it has to be done right away. So this process is really fast. And, you know, people don't realize even the end of the process, the paying of the checks, we've got an amazing treasurer, Lynn Minish, who, you know, every night is out there making sure that lights are kept on and things like that. Because you got to pay these bills. Very few veterans come to us and say, hey, I've got like in 6 months, I got this bill that's got to be paid. You know, they come to us because they've exhausted every avenue they can. They've gone to friends and family. They've exhausted all their savings. They've run up credit card bills just trying to keep their heads above water. That's when they come to us. They don't have anywhere else to turn. So these things have to happen unbelievably fast. And I think of all the things that our organization does, that's what I'm most proud of, is that the undying dedication to making sure these things get done and get done fast, so that we really are helping people in a way that I think people can't understand how unbelievably fast, but also how difficult that is, because we all have jobs and families and obligations. You know, Chris and I both have sat, you know, at different times on the distribution committee. That's a weekly call, 9 o'clock on a Monday. The last thing I want to do on a Monday is listen to some of these cases, because to be totally honest, they're not, you know, they're not fluffy kind of like feel good cases, right? These are all people having issues, going through a hard time. And sometimes we have to say no, they don't fit the mission, and we do our best to find places that do fit, and that doesn't feel great. So it's not the best way to end your Monday night, but it's an essential function. So, you know, it's to me, that's what I'm most proud of, is the dedication and the speed by which we do things.
Well, and Chris, Rob touched on it a little bit, and we're talking to Chris Cornelius, who's a co-founder and board member of Fallen Wounded Soldiers Fund, and its president, Robert Grimaldi. But Chris, he touched on it. A lot of this is just basic needs. I mean, you're helping a guy out, generally a guy, women, I'm assuming as well. But you're helping out with basic needs. Talk about those basic needs.
Well, I can give you a quick example of just one case if you'd like.
Go right ahead.
So we'll just call him Mr. L. So Mr. L came to us years ago, but this is a very common scenario for us even to this date. So he's 100% VA rated right now, or service connected right now. He was in an IED explosion, suffered PTSD, TBI, traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injuries, and needed help with the mortgage. They were facing evictions. So some of the needs, and this is where it gets really sad, is that diapers. He needed diapers, he needed baby food, and electricity. And at the time he called, he was using old T-shirts as diapers for his kids. So he received the VA rating, but the check hadn't started, and the military pay had stopped. It was 18 months that he was without income. So we took care of all his bills. We took care of him, his family, his kids, and that's what we're still doing today.
And these are, as I say, just sort of basic needs, the stuff the rest of us don't maybe think too much about, and that is, you know, food, clothing, shelter over your head. Hey, if your car breaks down, you can't get to work, or you can't get to the medical clinic anymore. I mean, this is really basic stuff, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, it's rare that somebody comes to us for something that's frivolous. It's happened over the years, and we that's not our role. It's the very, like you said, basic things. Sometimes people come to us, they're homeless, and so, it, you know, we try to get them into, we had a woman and her daughter just a couple weeks ago. They were living in their car. And then trying to find shelters here and there. Neither one of those are unbelievably safe places for a young woman and her daughter. And so we were able to find, you know, temporary housing for them, if you will, in a hotel. And then we're able to get them housing after that. But, you know, basic things like that. But then it does go into things like, you know, just trying to get assistance for food or for keeping the lights on, you know, mortgages. So I can't tell you how many times we get involved where somebody is 2 or 3 months behind on their rent and they've got an eviction notice. We wish they would have come to us a month earlier so we would have more time to sort of work through things. But again, they never come to us until they just can't, you know, cope with what's going on and keep up. And so it's never for anything frivolous. It's almost always for the very basics of the basics. Cars, rent, food, diapers, formula for the baby, things like that. And you know, unfortunately, with inflation and all those, the pinch we all feel at the grocery store, you know, veterans aren't immune to that, right? They have the same issues we have, right? So prices are going up across the board. So that hurts too when, you know, they're on assistance of whatever level. And so, you know, those things take a bigger bite out of the budget, which means there's less money available to keep the lights on or whatever it may be. You know, during COVID, we had a lot of veterans that just weren't set up to have, you know, three kids at home on their current Wi-Fi. They maybe didn't have the equipment or the you know, the available network to sort of log into, right? So those kind of things came up. We certainly weren't prepared for that in the sense that we didn't think that was coming. Nobody did during COVID, but you know, we had to then sort of pivot and respond to different kinds of needs. But those are the things, it's just keeping their heads above water, keeping them, you know, able to be in homes, keeping lights on, things like that. I will note one thing that we've done really in just the last couple of years that's been exciting is we opened a veterans housing center in Canton, Michigan, in a partnership with Canton. So, you know, again, keeping overhead unbelievably low, but having the ability to get the veterans into a housing center, but also to have a community of veterans that have gone through the same issues they've had, and a place to meet and talk to other veterans, you know, in an area where everybody's been in that same exact spot. So they can talk through issues. I can't tell a veteran what they're feeling. I've never been through what they're going through, but other veterans that have, they can have a different conversation. So those kind of things have been very helpful, especially post COVID era. But you're exactly right, Jim. It's never anything frivolous. It's always just basic needs.
Now, this we're going to reach through veteransradio.org here. We're going to reach nationally an audience that's going to hear for Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund for the first time. But, Chris, why don't we explain in your mission, what's your geographic territory? How does a veteran, if you will, qualify for reaching out?
So for us, they're either a Michigan resident deployed, or they're a current Michigan resident. So that's and a veteran honorably discharged. And then, you know, what we do is, like Rob was saying, we do help out with immediate needs. If you don't mind, I want to include one other thing, was that we also help when there's an injured and you were on the board at the time when we've had some injured veterans. They were deployed and something happened, and so we help bring that family together, incur that cost for them, and say, hey, we're here. You just focus on getting better. Bring the loved ones around that you need, and we'll take care of that. We had a soldier that was out at Fort Custer, two soldiers, and a tree fell on them, and one was very, very was injured very badly, and we helped his family heal. And then, you know, the real nice thing is that, like with Mr. L, he called up probably, I think it's probably 12 years later, and gave us a great thank you. You know, he left a voice message that was just beautiful, thanking us from the bottom of his heart. So the impact that we have on these folks, it's life-changing for them.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to give some you can't do this work without financial resources. And, Rob, I'd like you to give some shout-outs to some of the sponsors who've been helping the fund all these years to make sure that you can do the very good work we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you're starting to get into it. There's just so many of them. Some of the larger sponsors, and let's call them more well-known nationally. I mean, General Motors, GM here in Detroit has been a huge sponsor of us for quite a few years. You know, you get into a lot of other companies like, you know, Aero Strategies that you know, Jeff Stiers has been a supporter since day one, I think, and still is a supporter. You know, Chris, as a head of our corporate sponsors, I don't know if you want to jump in, maybe some of the ones that from day one through now. But I mean, there's, you know, if you go to the website, just as an aside, they're all kind of listed there as well. But that's the great thing about this organization is there's been so many people from across the board. And a lot of them have been sponsors, right? Chris, back me up here, 16, 17 years in some cases.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we still have some of the original board members. We have some of the original sponsors. We've had major pharmaceuticals. Cardinal Pharmaceuticals, Iafredi, great supporter. We have Aero, as you mentioned. Trillamed has been a supporter for years, and you know, I feel bad for just not rattling off more.
It's an unfair question, but I bring it up because if you want to help out, if you want to help veterans in this direct reach out approach, then you got to help with the finances, and the sponsors do that. But also participating in events. And one of the reasons we're talking is you have some upcoming events. Rob, you want to talk about those events?
Yeah, and you're exactly right that we can never raise enough money, right? Because when we raise, there's always need out there. And I know people might say, well, you know, the war is over. We're not seeing it in the news. But the kind of problems we're seeing today are the ones that, one, are a little harder to diagnose sometimes. You know, things like traumatic brain injury and things like that aren't always the easiest for you know, the physicians and the doctors to diagnose, especially when they're longer-term issues. But also, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, again, those debilitating injuries that are just building up. And so the need's actually bigger than it was. and it's for longer time, right? Each event we're helping tends to be a little bit longer than before. So, you know, we do have two events coming up. On September 11th is our annual September 11th Remembrance Golf Outing. And that'll be held at Shenandoah Golf Course here in the Detroit, Michigan area. And then April 19th is our annual gala. And so that, you know, we typically get a good crowd there, anywhere from, well, we sell out. That's always the goal, is to sell out of wherever we're going to be. And either one of those, you can find on our website, fwsf.org. And if you're unable to attend, or if you, you know, listening now and you like the mission, you like what we're doing, but you live someplace outside of Michigan, you know, it's easy to donate as well. There's a donate button on that front page. When you first get to the landing page of the website, you can click there, and that's a pretty easy process as well. But any of those three certainly helps. And if you're in the area, absolutely would love to have you out at the golf outing coming up in a few weeks. Like I said, September 11th. And you know, you can meet some of the board members, but you can also meet some of the people we help that'll be there at the event. And then just learn more about the organization. Happy to sit down with anybody that's there and kind of walk them through what we do.
Certainly glad to have the opportunity to talk to Rob Grimaldi, president, and Chris Cornelius, board member and co-founder of Fallen Wounded Soldiers Fund, to get a little bit more about what they do. Check us out at veteransradio.org and or Facebook. We always need your financial support as well. And Dale will be back next week with more stories and more interesting things to talk about. We always try to bring you stuff that maybe you don't hear somewhere else, or you're not going to get in the general press. So we search high and low for interesting stories and people to talk about, and certainly getting a chance to talk about what goes on behind the scenes in obtaining a Medal of Honor, as was done for Paris Davis, is really interesting. So I'm Jim Fossone with Veterans Radio. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.